Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Looking for Americans looking to Haiti.
This is not America.
The many Haitian expatriates and Haitian Americans in the U.S. have embraced the island nation in the months since the earthquake. Geology pushed it farther from North America. Humanity brings us closer together. Oh, but it is America. Haitian American communities on the front lines. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, February 12th, and The Takeaway is thinking about the Haitian Americans who have assisted in the aid operation in Haiti 1 month after that devastating earthquake. It's affected all of the communities. It's really affected Haitians everywhere in the world.
1 month at the beginning of probably a years-long effort to help Haiti recover. Let's get right to the top stories you're following this morning, though. Former President Bill Clinton is out of New York City Hospital and back at his home in Chappaqua this morning. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Dr. Stephen Nissen, a cardiologist at the Cleveland Clinic. He told us that the former president now has two stents in an artery around his heart.
A stent is a little mesh device made of metal. You prop it open, and then that stent is like a scaffolding that keeps the artery open for longer than if you just put a balloon in there alone.
Clinton's longtime friend Terry McAuliffe tells CBS, don't expect the former president to slow down anytime soon.
He was on the conference call as he was wheeled into the operating room. His aide, Doug Band, had to literally take the phone away from him. Yeah. He would have kept the phone on Haiti and talked right through the procedure if he could, but that's who he is.
The president could be back at work as early as Monday.
1 month ago today, as we said, the earth shook in Haiti, leaving a nation in ruins, around 100,000 dead or near dead, and another million homeless. Today, Haiti observes a national day of mourning with a ceremony to be held near the ruins of the National Palace in Port-au-Prince. Earlier, we spoke to Nick Davis, a correspondent for our partner, the BBC. He's in Port-au-Prince, and we asked Nick how the rainy season will affect the remaining people in those temporary shelters in Port-au-Prince.
Yesterday we were woken up by the sound of rain coming down, the first heavy rain since the earthquake a month ago today. I came out to see what the situation was, but it was really when I spoke to people who we've been meeting with over the last few weeks. There was a young man called Prophet, 18 years old. His home was destroyed in the quake. He's living in a makeshift tent, just held up with barely pieces of rope and string attached to wooden poles, and he said they had to hide, you know, anywhere they could, you know, including in the sort of remnants of the buildings which they'd actually escaped from a month ago, because they were just concerned about the amount of water coming down. And when water does come down here, when the rain does come down, the roads get flooded. It's a real foretaste of what could happen when the rainy season starts.
And are Haitians going to elude Mother Nature's wrath this time around? They certainly didn't for the earthquake.
That's right. Well, you know, really, people are putting their faith in God. This is a highly Christian country, and people are turning to their faith. They're really turning their prayers to the Lord that things cannot get any worse. You know, they're praying to Him, and it's amazing how resilient people are. And it has to be said, much of that comes from their faith.
Right.
When you ask them about the situation, they really are very positive.
Speaking to us a few hours ago, Nick Davis, correspondent for our partner, the BBC, from Port-au-Prince. The Winter Olympics in Vancouver get underway today with the first ever indoor opening ceremonies tonight. We want you to be a part of that. It looks like fun to me, the Winter Olympics. What event would you want to compete in or just try? 877-8-MY-TAKE or invent a new Olympic event at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Join the conversation.
Taking a look at the markets, Asian and European markets are mixed. Futures are down. The Dow will start at 10,144, the S&P at 1,078, and the Nasdaq opens at 21,000. 77. So coming up, Valentine's Day, not just a movie on, not just a day on Sunday, but a movie. We're going to talk about movies that perhaps are better for Valentine's than the film Valentine's Day. And we're going to check in on Haiti in just a moment.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
We've seen the pictures of mourning every single day now in the last month from that Haitian earthquake. It is an official day of mourning, though, today, because it is exactly 1 month after the worst earthquake in probably 200 years, perhaps the worst earthquake in recorded history in this Western Hemisphere. And communities around North America, particularly in the U.S., are embracing Haiti as never before, forming a humanitarian lifeline across the water. I said Haiti was an island nation there at the top of the hour. It actually isn't. It's part of the island of Hispaniola, along with the Dominican Republic. But literally, there is a bridge now to the nation and people of Haiti. And we're going to examine what's been going on in these expatriate communities around the United States and the world over the last month. We're joined by George Marie Jasmine, a coordinator for the City of Boston's Referral and Support Center for Haitian Americans. She joins us from our partner station, WGBH in Boston. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Rico Dupuy is station manager of Radio Soleil. We've spoken with him here in New York City, where there's a huge Haitian American community. Good morning, Rico.
Good morning. Good morning.
And Jepsy Metalus, executive director of Saint-La, a Haitian neighborhood center in Miami. We've spoken to you before, and good morning once again, Jepsy.
Good morning.
First of all, George Marie Jasmine, how has the community in Boston really changed and evolved and perhaps become closer to the people of Haiti in the extraordinary weeks since the earthquake?
I think that's a great question. The city of Boston has become closer, and I think it is due to our mayor, Thomas M. Menino, who, in the aftermath of the earthquake, initiated a citywide response to support the Haitian community in Boston.
And does this sort of resonate in the churches and the institutions? Is it sort of house to house? Is it families working together? I mean, certainly the resources were given to you by the mayor's office, but it's really the community that has the connections.
Correct. The churches, the community-based organizations, private agencies, and also families and different members of the community have come together to respond to this crisis.
Mm-hmm. Rico Dupuy, how's your playlist changed over the last month? And certainly on the air, you've been doing a whole lot of literal humanitarian work.
Well, our program has changed completely. To start, I can tell you, basically, there is no dance music on the station. Dance music programs have been changed into either call-in shows or news shows. So that's not easy because you do have constituencies who want to hear music, although I'm prepared to admit that 95% of my listeners, they entirely comfortable with the idea of not playing dance music on the station.
You know, often in expatriate diaspora communities around the world, there's something of a tension between the people who left for whatever reason and the people who stayed behind in the native land. And I'm wondering if that issue has changed at all in the sort of remarkable response to the people of Haiti since the earthquake. Rico?
You mean a difference of views?
A sense of greater closeness, a sense of we have our responsibility here outside of Haiti and the people inside of Haiti have their role to play as well.
Has hit, as far as I'm concerned, not the country of Haiti, but the Haitian nation, which is form of Haitians in Haiti and Haitians overseas in the diaspora. As far as we're concerned, all of us are hit immediately, directly, in a big way. I don't know of any Haitian in the diaspora that is not directly, immediately affected by this. So all of us, we've lost family members, close friends. As far as I'm concerned, there is really no difference in the way this thing is felt by Haitians both here and in Haiti.
Gypsy Metalus, would you agree that there is now a Haitian nation and it's not really an island? It embodies virtually all of the Western Hemisphere?
Well, John, there's always been a Haitian nation, but and I think that the in the wake of this earthquake, we're seeing again this world nation, these people from throughout the diaspora come together to be of aid to Haiti, to be of support, and to mourn with the fellow Haitians on the island, and mourn the impact of this catastrophe.
What's happening specifically in Miami? How have the institutions responded and changed? And are there clubs and gathering places in Miami that have changed their role from one of maybe entertainment and just sort of cultural gathering to one of humanitarian?
I have to first thank just about everybody throughout the state of Florida, throughout the country, throughout the world, really, for what's been unprecedented generosity. I'm talking from average individuals to media outlets to governments, entertainers, first responders, hospital workers, students, public and private sector institutions. Just everybody has just been phenomenal and tremendous in their solidarity and their support and their caring about Haiti and wanting to help and transforming whatever space they had to one where supplies could be gathered for relief.
Well, that's a great sort of takeaway idea, that it's really not about solidarity among Haitians, even though that's an issue. It's solidarity among Haitians with their neighbors of all races and ethnicities here in the United States. Rica Dupuy, would you agree in New York that's what's going on?
Absolutely, and I would say it's really what's happening throughout the world. I don't know of any group, ethnic, any community that is not somehow, directly or indirectly, involved in some kind of rescue effort. I've seen artists from all ethnic groups. In fact, I went to a concert, a fundraiser by Jewish artists United for Haiti. That was so moving, so much emotion. I decided to talk to the organizers and so that I can broadcast the three-hour concert on my radio,
wow,
which we'll be doing this Sunday.
On Radio Soleil, right here in New York.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, Georges Marie Jasmine, are we all Haitians? Is that the takeaway here?
We are all Haitians. The outpouring of support that we've seen here in Boston has been overwhelming and quite humbling. And people from all walks of life just wanting to support and be considerate.
Well, Georges Marie Jasmine, coordinator for the City of Boston's Referral and Support Center for Haitians in Haiti and Haitian Americans. We're all Haitians up in Boston and down here in New York. It's true as well. Rica Dupuy, station manager at Radio Soleil, and Gypsy Metalouse, executive director of Sant La Haitian Neighborhood Center in Miami. Thanks to all of you. 1 month since the Haitian earthquake. We are all Haitians. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some of the stories we're following.
Former President Bill Clinton is out of the hospital a day after doctors opened a blocked artery around his heart. Former Democratic National Committee Chairman Terry McAuliffe tells CBS this morning the former president is in good spirits.
If I know President Clinton, he'll be on the phone soon calling people asking for more help for Haiti and where he can get pickup trucks so they can deliver food or generators. But you know, if I know Bill Clinton, he'll be raring to go.
Clinton is expected to spend today recovering at his home in Chappaqua, New York. We've just been talking about Haiti. In another piece of news from the country, a Haitian judge has said 10 jailed American missionaries should be released while child kidnapping charges against them are investigated. Their Haitian lawyer is jubilant at the ruling.
There's no violation of Haitian law. Everything is becoming clear now.
The missionaries will likely spend the weekend in jail, though, while prosecutors try to mount an appeal.
Iraq has officially kicked off its election season ahead of a nationwide vote in March. Campaign ads plaster Iraqi cities, but uncertainty still surrounds many candidates who were told they couldn't run because of alleged links to the outlawed Ba'ath Party. Officials in Nigeria say the U.S. has demanded various security conditions Nigeria needs to meet to be removed from the U.S. terror watch list. Nigeria was put on the list after a Nigerian man was accused of trying to blow up an airliner over the U.S. on Christmas Day. Predictions of an inch or two of snow are enough to shut down schools in the Florida Panhandle. A storm system left nearly a foot of snow in the Dallas area. It's going to brush the Sunshine State. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, Olympic fever. Are the people of Vancouver getting up in arms about the invasion?
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our news takeouts begin with the Winter Olympics. The opening ceremony is set for later tonight, beginning 2 weeks of sports talk, sports pictures, and the traditional, you know, every two-year Olympic obsession of the entire world. Our buddy Dave Zirin joins us, sports journalist, author of the forthcoming book, Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love. So it seems that, like a lot of host cities, having the Olympics doesn't look real good on the ground once the games actually start. Is there some Canadian angst up there in Vancouver?
There sure is. I just got back from Vancouver, actually, spending a week just breaking in the shoe leather, talking to people. And the difference between this Olympics, though, and other Olympics is that it's the first post-global recession Olympics. So you're seeing the coinciding with the normal angst about over budgets, projects not coming in on time, stepped up security, lax transportation for locals. But when that's coupled with the fact that there's less corporate underwriting and more public spending, yeah, it's led to a lot of angst.
So to a lot of Canadians, the Olympics feels like a tax, not so much a ceremony. How is it taking out its frustration?
Well, it's interesting. You look at the polls, and over 60% of people in British Columbia say too much has been spent. 50% say that they're glad the Olympics are there. And this is the big one, though. 40% of people in British Columbia say that they have sympathies or they side with people who will be protesting the Olympics in Vancouver.
Wow, that's amazing. So some of the spectacles may be those protests, not just the games.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's the Olympic protests are as old as the Olympics themselves. Even in the 36 Olympics in Nazi Germany, people protested things like the destruction of housing to make way for the Games. But this one is different in that protesters have called for what they call a Seattle model protest, like treating the Olympics basically like it's an IMF, World Bank, or World Trade Organization meeting, and calling for protesters both from around Canada but also from the United States as well to come to Vancouver to be part of a protest.
Globalization, potentially the main event at the Winter Olympics, according to Dave Zirin, sports journalist, author of the forthcoming Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love, just back from Vancouver. Thanks, Dave.
We're following Asian carp also as they make their way towards the Great Lakes. Yesterday we told you about a federal plan to keep this invasive species out of Lake Michigan. The government's planning to spend almost $80 million to fix this problem, but officials in Michigan and the other Great Lakes states say that is not even close to enough. They say they need urgent help to stop the problem before the carp overrun the Great Lakes. Michigan and four other states filed a lawsuit in the Supreme Court last December to close off the canal that links the Great Lakes to the Mississippi River Basin. The White House is trying to play mediator in all of this. They set up a meeting between the states and the Department of Justice that did not solve the dispute. So joining us now is Detroit Free Press environment writer Tina Lamb. Good morning, Tina.
Good morning.
What is at issue here? We hear some very dire statements coming out of biologists and scientists who study the ecosystem around the Great Lakes, what they call a very fragile ecosystem, actually. What is the danger of these Asian carp?
Well, Celeste, the main thing that is the danger is that these fish can grow very large, and when they do that, they eat all the food, especially the small plankton, that other fish need, and so they can outcompete them. The other thing is that some of them can weigh more than a bowling ball, and they leap out of the water and can actually injure boaters.
8 to 10 feet they can leap.
Oh, yes. There are lots of videos on the web showing them doing exactly that.
Yeah, they're amazing videos. They almost look photoshopped. So
it's like kung fu carp. I mean, it's totally
if it weren't an actual danger to destroy the ecosystem of the largest freshwater system in the world, you know, it would almost be funny. But it's not funny. The issue here is whether or not $80 million coming from the federal government is enough. Why is that not enough money?
Well, the main problem is that what Michigan is seeking, and the other states as well, is to actually close off this canal between the Mississippi and the Great Lakes. And it would take far more than $80 million to do that. That $80 million is really just a stopgap type of funding for research and trying to get rid of as many carp as possible. But that is really not going to take care of the problem.
Well, I'm sure we'll hear more about this as the lawsuit proceeds. Tina Lamb is the environment writer for the Detroit Free Press. Thank you so much. And we do have some of that amazing carp video on our website. You can see it at thetakeaway.org.
Asian carp trying to have a good week. Well, it's Friday with our friends at The Week magazine. Let's see who had a good week and who didn't. All right, listen to this story. Long Island motorist Kathleen Fasanella was caught red-handed trying to pull a fast one. She was driving to work using the Long Island Expressway's HOV lane, but her bad week started when an officer noticed that her passenger was wearing kind of thick glasses.
It was a cloudy morning, and that really raised the suspicions a little bit for a closer look. When he came up next to the vehicle, it became apparent to him that, in fact, this was not a real passenger. It was a fully dressed mannequin, complete with a wig, sunglasses, blouse, blue blazer, and a scarf.
The old mannequin in the sunglasses trick. Well, it didn't fool Suffolk County Police Chief Michael Sharkey. Kathleen got a $135 traffic summons. Her mannequin actually had a worse week. It's currently on view at the Suffolk County Police Department.
Although I love the fact that she accessorized the mannequin with a scarf. That's who had a bad week. Now for a good week, we go to Madison, Wisconsin.
A working class hero is something to be.
On Sunday, the Wisconsin State Journal reported the city's highest paid employees. You'd think it was the mayor, right?
No. Was it John Lennon?
It was not. In fact, it was bus driver John E. Lee. He raked in nearly $160,000. About two-thirds of that came from overtime and union benefits.
And, of course, you had your nominees.
My name is Daniel, calling from Beaufort, South Carolina. My nominee for who's having a good week is Jenny Sanford, who's been on pretty much every television show for the past week.
Coming up live on The View, Jenny Sanford's revealing why she wrote a...
She has left her husband, and she's written...
Soon-to-be ex-wife of South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford, Jenny Sanford.
For who's having a bad week, I would say her husband, who's alone in the governor's mansion.
Send your nominations to us at 877-8MYTAKE, or you can post them to our site, thetakeaway.org, and you can check out the full Good Week, Bad Week feature in The Week magazine, which is on newsstands and online right now.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. At 30 minutes past the hour, here are some of the news stories that we're following this morning. Former President Bill Clinton is out of a New York City hospital and back at his home in Chappaqua this morning. His heart specialist gave him this excellent prognosis.
I told him he could be back in the office on Monday.
Coming up, we'll talk more about the procedure he went through and how you can better avoid heart troubles in a few moments. It is a national day of mourning in Haiti to mark the one-month anniversary of the earthquake that left around 200,000 dead and a million homeless. A ceremony will be held near the ruins of the National Palace in Port-au-Prince.
On Capitol Hill, Senate Democrats proposing a new stripped-down jobs bill. New York Senator Charles Schumer says it will still have tax breaks for small businesses that hire new workers.
If companies are about to say, hey, maybe I'll hire someone, this will push them over the edge.
The price tag for the package would be at least $15 billion over the next decade. Just out, retail sales for January, they're up unexpectedly. It's turned around the markets. The futures trading is now up because retail sales were up by 0.5%. If you take autos out of the picture, it's 0.6%. That's positive news. Asian and European markets are mixed. The Dow gets underway at 10,144. The S&P opens at 1,078. And expect a turnaround as the NASDAQ starts trading at 2,177. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
As we've been reporting, former President Bill Clinton was released from the hospital. He was admitted yesterday after experiencing chest pains. Two stents were placed in one of his coronary arteries, and by all accounts, the procedure went swimmingly. It's not Clinton's first brush with heart trouble, though. Here's the president back in 2005. He's talking about a routine procedure he underwent as a follow-up to his quadruple bypass in 2004.
It is not a dangerous procedure unless something totally unpredictable happens. My ribs will hurt for 2 or 3 weeks, and then I'll go back to my life. And so it's just no big deal. I don't think it's not useful to sit around and worry about things you have no control over.
But to what extent is heart trouble something you can't control? Can you predict or even avoid heart trouble? 26% of American deaths are related to heart disease. And those are diseases that our next guest, Dr. Steve Nissen, chair of cardiovascular medicine at the Cleveland Clinic, says are largely avoidable. Good morning, doctor.
Good morning.
First, let's get the concerns over President Clinton out of the way. That the president is not in danger at this point, or we don't know?
Well, he's done very well, and this is quite typical, frankly. A bypass surgery doesn't cure heart disease. It provides an alternative route for blood around the blocked arteries, and what happened was one of those bypasses, went down and caused him to have recurrence of his chest pain. What they did was put two stents in the original native coronary artery to restore blood flow, and in the short term, his prognosis is quite good.
What is a stent?
A stent is a little mesh device made of metal that you prop into the coronary, you put a balloon inside of it, you prop it open, and then that stent is like a scaffolding that keeps the artery open for longer than if you just put a balloon in there alone.
Well, how long does a stent last?
It can last indefinitely, but there is, you know, the problem of an underlying disease that tends to progress. And so the problem is usually now not that the stent narrows, but that some other area in the artery develops this plaque buildup that causes the disease in the first place, and that a new blockage occurs.
So we could very likely see the president returning often to get updates or new treatments for heart disease.
Well, maybe not often, but certainly, you know, he could in a few years have some difficulty again. You know, we live this with our patients all the time. You know, they go through a series of these things, and fortunately now we've got pretty good tools to get people through these crises, and they then can go back to being fully active.
You may have heard, as we did, that the president was taking a conference call about Haiti relief efforts while he was being wheeled, or just before he was wheeled in for this surgery. And this is one thing that analysts seized on immediately, his breakneck schedule, his stressful schedule. How much is stress a factor in heart disease? Is it true that a type A personality, a stressful person with a stressful job, is more likely to develop heart disease?
You know, many of us just don't buy that. You know, we all live stressful lives. You know, if you can point to stress in every disease, I don't think the evidence is very good that stress is the problem. In fact, if you really think about it, the whole purpose of modern therapies is to allow people to stay active. People like President Clinton, to do the things they love to do successfully, you know, even though they have coronary artery disease.
So talk to me a little bit about, you know, Clinton's got this outsized personality. Okay, maybe stress isn't hurting his heart, but you certainly get feelings of mortality when these episodes start to proceed. What are the psychological consequences of something like this?
Well, there's a big problem. And, you know, we did hear the story that he had some difficulty for a couple of days before he came into the hospital. I must say, and you know, for your listeners, this is quite typical. And the problem is denial. You know, people have this, you know, fear of the mortality of the disease, and so they do exactly the wrong thing. They frequently will do other things. They'll take, you know, they'll sip some bicarbonate. They'll take a Tums. They'll do whatever they can do not to call their cardiologist or to go directly to the hospital. What they need to do, if you have known heart disease, when you have tightness or pain in the chest, you know, you need to get to the hospital because it could be pretty serious and it needs to be intervened upon in a prompt fashion.
Heart disease is a big problem in the U.S. 26% of deaths in this country are due to heart disease. And you have said that many of these deaths are largely preventable.
Well, if you look at the data, approximately 3/4 of the events can be linked to risk factors that we can treat. High blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, smoking. Some of these things are things that are pretty easy to get rid of. I mean, smoking, if you can stop, your risk goes down almost immediately and keeps going down for a long period of time. We can treat high blood pressure. We can treat high cholesterol. What I worry about for President Clinton is I want to make certain that he's getting the absolute best preventive care available. I assume that he is, but he's got a partner with his doctors, and he's got to take those medicines. He's got to at least follow up to make sure he's really on track.
Well, certain things that are risk factors, let's say if you're overweight as a child, as the president was, once you lose that weight, does that risk go away?
Well, there's a lot that we don't know about that. And, you know, obesity in and of itself is not the strongest risk factor. And he's by no means obese. He's
not
got
anymore, yeah.
He's got a paunch around the middle, as many of us do. You know, the problem with obesity is it leads to many other things like diabetes and high blood pressure and high cholesterol. So if you factor those other things out of the equation, you know, being a little bit overweight per se is not necessarily the problem.
But the problem is, it sounds like you're saying, being a know-it-all and trying to second-guess your doctors.
Yeah, you know, I think that it's important no matter how smart you are. You know, we all know that President Clinton is a brilliant man, that he's got to take the advice of his doctor. He's got to talk to him. He's got to listen to them. He's got to try to follow their advice. And I hope he's doing that.
Well, he is a brilliant man, but he is not a doctor. And that's Dr. Stephen Nissen, chair of the cardiovascular medicine at Cleveland Clinic. Coming up, we're going to talk about movies. We always talk about movies on Fridays. And with Valentine's Day coming up.
Movies again.
Valentine's Day coming up. You know, the typical Valentine's Day date, dinner and a movie, right? We have a trivia question for you. In these top 25 grossing romantic comedies of all time, two questions for you for each movie.
Yep.
Did the guy get the girl?
That's always
and
what you
who's
want to know.
The girl? Here's the three movies. Sleepless in Seattle, Jerry Maguire, Ghost. Give us your answer at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and the answer is coming up later this hour. And by the way, go to our website anyway, because we're holding a contest, a dog show. The Westminster Dog Show is coming up next week. And so we want photos of your canine friend, and we're going to judge best in show with our listeners. So here's what you do. You post your photos on the Facebook page. We're going to talk about them next week, and you can get instructions on how to do that at thetakeaway.org. Well, I'm sorry for you, because it's going to be fun. I've posted my dog's.
And your little dog, too.
I've posted my dog's picture up on there. You can see my beagle and some of our staff members' dogs as well, and a lot from our listeners. Don't worry, cat owners. We're going to have something for you as well.
Go
to
our
Facebook or thetakeaway.org. Stop being such a downer about this. Dogs are awesome.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. So when you think of Olympic skiing, you may hear something like this. You know, one person against the snowy mountain slopes, right?
Nice.
But this year's Olympic Games, skiing is going to sound a little bit different. Listen to how ski cross competitors Casey Puckett and Darren Rolfs describe their sport to NBC.
Skier cross is just a race from the top to the bottom. And four guys hopping into a gate and saying, I'm going to be the first one to finish.
It's like motocross on skis. How could you not like that?
How could you not like that? So it's sort of like a mob going down a hill. Look online, and you can see what ski cross looks like. Tyler Shepard joins us. He's the ski cross coach for Team USA. Thanks so much for being with us from out there in Vancouver.
Thank you very much, John.
So, first of all, you know, ski cross is really what you're always tempted to do when you're on the slopes, if you're good, to be part of a kind of a ski mob going from top to the bottom of the mountain. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, I would say if anybody's out there with their friends, there's not a time that you probably don't say at one point in time, first one at the bottom wins, or, you know, last one down has to buy the beers or whatever. You know, you're buying.
Exactly. And so this is turned into an actual Olympic sport, and it's one of the X Games sports, right?
Yes, it's been part of the X Games, I believe, since 97 or 98. So they've been a strong supporter and certainly been leading the way to help us get to where the sport is today.
Now, a lot of the extreme sport players in both the Winter Games and in the Summer Games are not known for their, you know, absolute kind of traditional reverence for the Olympic gold medal. Is that the case with the ski cross? They like to play, but it's just another competition for a lot of these guys.
Well, on top of my head, I don't think there's any of them that have been to the Olympics. So it's going to be a first-time experience for a lot of the athletes at the ski cross this year. So there's a lot on the line, and the gold medal is going to certainly mean a lot.
But Rolfs and Puckett were both injured at the games last month, the Winter X Games. I mean, this is a really dangerous event. And what were they doing, like putting themselves at risk right before the Olympics?
Well, at the beginning of the year, I set out a plan, and we all sit down, not just me, but also the higher-ups at the organization of the United States Ski and Snowboard Association, and that was the plan. You know, each one had a specific plan, this number of races to stay sharp and certainly reach other goals that they're both reaching for. And, you know, X Games is always one of the best courses, so it doesn't come down to a more dangerous course or anything. It comes down to anything can really happen.
Right.
And in terms of their injuries, Casey's injury actually happened in France, not in Aspen, contrary to what the media has been saying.
Well, but basically what it comes down to is that the games, the Winter X Games, are just too basically awesome to miss. And so you run these kinds of risks. How do you get young people to come into this sport when you can dislocate your hip doing it?
Well, in all reality, Darren could have dislocated his hip just free skiing that morning. It was, a crash that happened by himself. No one caused it. So young kids, I think, see it and they get really excited because you're like a kid in a candy store. The jumps are always really fun, and you're going fast, and it's fun to go head-to-head in competition because you get immediate gratification when you win because you're beating that person right there. It's not always against the clock.
The definition of totally awesome, and it's now in the Olympics. Ski cross, Tyler Shepard, ski coach for the ski cross team for Team USA. Tyler, thanks so much, and good luck.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, we're going to look for some alternatives to Valentine's Day. Not the holiday, the movie that opens this weekend. And here's your trivia question for Movie Week or Movie Friday in these top 25 grossing romantic comedies of all time. Two questions now. Did the guy get the girl? And who's the girl? The movies are Ghost, Sleepless in Seattle, and Jerry Maguire. You can go to our website for a reminder of that question. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at just after 48 minutes after the hour. Some mournful sounds there of Haitians this morning singing hymns at the site of a mass grave where it's thought tens of thousands of earthquake victims are buried. Today marks 1 month after the quake that killed around 200,000 people. Here in the U.S., former President Bill Clinton has been released from a New York hospital following a heart procedure. Close friend Terry McAuliffe told CBS News he's raring to get back to work.
This is not going to change it. I hear these people say, oh, will he slow down? That's not President Clinton. If anything, he's going to redouble his efforts if there's time to actually redouble what President Clinton does.
Clinton is expected to spend today recovering at his home in Chappaqua, New York. Terry McAuliffe's job, by the way, is to just talk about Bill Clinton, apparently.
In weather news, folks from Louisiana to coastal South Carolina are bracing for a rare winter snowstorm, something many there haven't seen in a decade or longer. The same storm already left Dallas with 9 inches of snow where they probably have maybe one snowplow. There's also been a serious security breach at the oil company Shell. Personal contact details for tens of thousands of its staff worldwide have been leaked to human rights and environmental campaigners. BBC business reporter Linda Duffin has been following the story. She spoke with us earlier from London. I asked her how serious a problem this is for Shell.
It's very definitely a serious security breach for Shell, Celeste. What we're told it involves is the leaking of the contact details of all of Shell's employees and contractors around the world, about 170,000 people, including workers in the United States. And these details include office phone numbers and zip codes of staff. But perhaps more worryingly is the leaking of personal numbers of those staff who usually work from home.
And this could put these employees in danger in some parts of the world?
Potentially, yes. Shell has staff in some pretty dangerous places like Nigeria, where there's violence in the main oil-producing region and where foreign workers are often kidnapped. Indeed, three of Shell's staff were abducted and then released just last month. Shell's playing down the seriousness of this security breach. It says the information is primarily business-related. But an executive at the company appears to have taken a different view about this when the information was leaked. I spoke to a blogger earlier today who'd been sent this data, and he emailed an executive at Shell. He reproduced the conversation on his website, and he quotes the Shell executive as saying some of the information is sensitive from the security point of view, and in some cases, personal safety could be compromised by its publication.
And this was a group of employees of Shell who actually leaked this information, some of them American employees, correct?
So it said, this is one of the most intriguing parts of the story. A note attached to all this information claimed that 116 concerned Shell staff had leaked the information because they're unhappy with the way that the company operates. The note says that they want what they call a peaceful corporate revolution. Shell, though, says it doesn't believe this part of the claim is genuine, but it has confirmed that it set up an investigation to try and find out who leaked the information and how they got hold of it.
Okay, business reporter Linda Duffin for our partner, the BBC. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
Let's go out to dinner and see a movie. Let's go out to dinner and see a movie.
A lot of dinner and movieing this Valentine's Day weekend, and our movie segment really refers to the movie Valentine's Day, which comes out this weekend. It's kind of a tried and true Hollywood formula. You take a million stars, you load them onto a bus, you give them a few lines, give them some plots, and you come up with something like this.
Valentine's Day. It comes every year, whether you like it or not.
It's Valentine's Day today?
Hello?
No, it's a Monday. Valentine's Day always falls on a Thursday.
Who's your head? That's Thanksgiving. So
sad. It can be complicated.
Alex and I were supposed to have sex.
I can't tolerate that. Now turn that off. Just turn it off. Just turn it off.
Jay,
that's the trailer from Valentine's Day, which comes out today. I don't know. Maybe some people have a choice. Do I go to see Valentine's Day or see something else? Rafer Guzman, our movie critic. First of all, good morning.
Morning.
Is there an alternative to Valentine's Day if I'm not sort of torn between the two?
I think there is if you're willing to stay home and rent something. You know, Valentine's Day has got, I think, 21 stars in it and probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 to 10 major storylines. You know, I was thinking about comparing it to a Hallmark card, but it's really almost a Hallmark card with like 30 extra pages of verse stapled in the middle of it. It's like the longest Hallmark card you'll ever read.
And you can get the stars or the star power and the plot lines in other movies.
I think you can. I think you can at least see some of this stuff done better.
All right, let's check it out.
Yeah, if you take the main narrative, which is Ashton Kutcher as a florist who is dating Jessica Alba, but of course he really belongs with his best friend who is Jennifer Garner, and takes them a while to realize that they have these feelings for each other. That's a plot line I'm always a little skeptical of, you know, the idea that you could fall for someone that's been around you for several years and not realize it. But it's a favorite in Hollywood, and I think a better option to that would be Clueless.
Cher's got attitude about high school boys.
It's a personal choice every woman has got to make for themselves.
Cher's saving herself for Luke Perry.
Cher, you're a virgin?
I mean, I'm not prude. I'm just highly selective. I mean, you see how picky I am about my shoes, and they only go on my feet.
It's a great suggestion. That's Alicia Silverstone in the Clueless 1995 movie. That was a great flick.
Paul Rudd playing the romance there.
All right, so let's try for another alternative. That's the one plot line that's in Valentine's Day.
Yeah, that's just the beginning.
Okay.
I'm only going to concentrate on a few here. I guess one of the next major ones would be Topher Grace, who plays this nice kid from Indiana who's dating Anne Hathaway. And what he doesn't know about her, she works at an office and she's an ambitious career girl. What he doesn't know about her is that she's actually moonlighting as a phone sex operator.
Okay.
And actually, she's pretty good in the movie. She's one of the funniest things about it. It gives her a good chance to sneak off and do a lot of these crazy monologues with different foreign accents.
But forget all that. What's the alternative?
The alternative, I would say, would be Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down, the Pedro Almodovar movie. You've got Antonio Banderas, who's in love with a porn actress.
That's a good one.
That seemed a much more realistic movie to me.
All right. Now, I heard the voice of Hector Elizondo and Shirley MacLaine in this trailer, and, they're not exactly Ashton Kutcher and Demi Moore. Can you think of a better movie with their storyline?
I would say you'd have to look all the way back to On Golden Pond to find a movie that addressed a romance between people of that age. Usually Hollywood is going to cap a romance somewhere in the 50s, like It's Complicated.
Right.
But, Henry Fonda and Katharine Hepburn, they were also in their 70s at the time when that movie came out.
Well, let's hear.
You are a pretty old dame, aren't you? What are you doing with a daddy or something like me?
Well, I haven't the vaguest idea.
Now, that, of course, was Henry Fonda's last movie, right?
That's
right. There was all kinds of drama at the Academy Awards. So there were stories in that movie and outside of that movie.
That's right.
And that's all rentable, right?
That's all rentable.
All right, so let's delve into the most youth-oriented storyline in the movie, okay? It focuses on a fifth grader and his crush. Tell me about that.
So he's got a crush... Again, I don't want to spoil it. He's got a crush on two people, let's say, in this movie, and he finds out that one of them is actually the right one for him. And I think this is an unconventional choice, but I think a good option that would be Let the Right One In, the Swedish vampire movie from a couple years ago, which is also about two very, very young kids, probably 9 or 10, and they've got this really beautiful, tender relationship in that movie. And it's being remade as well, actually.
Such sophisticated taste. Okay, let's just do a recap. If you want an alternative to Valentine's Day, go rent Clueless, or Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down, or On Golden Pond, or Let the Right One In.
That's what I'd say.
Rafer Guzman with some alternatives for Valentine's Day. You ready for trivia?
I'm ready.
You ready? Okay. In these top 25 grossing romantic comedies of all time, two questions. Did the guy get the girl, yes or no, and who's the girl? Number one, Sleepless in Seattle.
The girl, Meg Ryan?
Yes.
I'm going to say yes, he gets her.
You're correct.
All right.
It's you.
It's me.
Jerry Maguire.
Renee Zellweger. And
correct.
He does get her.
Excellent.
You had me at hello.
Excellent. And what about Ghost?
That's Demi Moore is the girl, right?
Correct.
And he does not get her.
Why?
I think because he's dead.
Yes, you're right, Rafer Guzman, trivia master. Go to our website. You can get a sneak peek at what we're working on for the next day. Just go to thetakeaway.org and click on blog, and you can see all our movie suggestions. Rafer Guzman, news critic, or movie critic of Newsday. Thanks so much.
And while you're at the website, thetakeaway.org, we have a special project that needs your photos.
God loves us.
terrier. Yes, he does. God loves a terrier.
The Westminster Dog Show is coming up next week, and we're going to have our own dog show here while John is away. We're going to have fun. Send us a photo of your pet, and we're going to do the best in show with our listeners and without John. You can post your photos to our Facebook page. We're going to talk about them next week. You can get instructions on how to do that at thetakeaway.org. And if you check out our Facebook page now, you can see a picture of my dog, some of our staff members' dogs, and a lot of our listeners. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. Pet pictures on the internet. Wow, that's innovative.
Go
this
on
is
vacation.
The Takeaway.
Jackie Robinson integrated baseball in 1947. Willie Thrower was the first black NFL quarterback more than half a century ago. That seems like ancient history in a way, but remember, it's only been 4 years since we got our first African-American individual gold medalist. There are still racial lines in sports that have yet to be crossed. But when the Olympic Games begin tonight in Vancouver, we'll get one more first. The world's first black figure skating pair will glide onto the ice and into the history books. Vanessa James and Yannick Bonheur skating for France, but with the eyes of the world upon them. They are the French national champions, carrying the torch for minority athletes around the globe. Vanessa James and Yannick Bonheur on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Friday, February 12th. And you know, John, it's a statistic that surprised me. It's only been 4 years since the first African-American won an individual gold medal in the Winter Olympics.
The Winter Olympics. Another reason to tune into figure skating. Believe me, figure skating is hard for me. So thanks.
Really?
Thanks for the story.
Well, you're a guy.
I guess. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. Former President Bill Clinton out of a New York City hospital and back at his home in Chappaqua this morning following yesterday's heart procedure. Clinton's longtime friend Terry McAuliffe tells CBS News, don't expect the former president to slow down anytime soon.
He was on the conference call as he was wheeled into the operating room. His aide, Doug Band, had to literally take the phone away from him. Yeah. He would have kept the phone on Haiti and talked right through the procedure if he could, but that's who he is.
President could be back at work as early as Monday. 1 month ago today, the earth shook for 40 terrifying seconds in Haiti, leaving about 200,000 people dead or near dead and leveling most of the capital city. It's a national day of mourning today with a ceremony to be held in the ruins of the National Palace in Port-au-Prince. Rolandra's Prophet, a Haitian teacher, tells our partner, the BBC, this morning, the disaster has brought Haitians closer together.
You know, the earthquake is now definitely a landmark in the life of this nation. Now people are very united, people have come together. So we can say it's like a patriotic day where people like come together and see themselves as Haitians and that they have to like rely on each other.
Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Rico Dupuy, who runs a Haitian radio station, Radio Soleil, right here in New York City.
This earthquake has hit not the country of Haiti, but the Haitian nation, which is form of Haitians in Haiti and Haitians overseas in the diaspora.
At 4:53 Eastern, the exact time the earthquake hit, what Rico calls the Haitian nation is being asked to kneel and pray.
A disturbing story out of Ohio. A new report on human trafficking estimates that about 1,000 American-born children are forced into the sex trade in Ohio every year. It also says about 800 immigrants are sexually exploited and pushed into sweatshop-style jobs. Celia Williamson joins us now. She's a professor in the University of Toledo's Social Work Department. She's leading the research efforts at the Ohio Trafficking in Persons Study Commission, which published its latest report on Monday. Celia, people don't often associate human trafficking with American cities. How big of a problem is this in the U.S.?
Oh, I think we're just starting to uncover that it's a large problem here.
And is it possible that a kid can get involved in this without a parent knowing?
Oh, yeah. There are several trafficking techniques used to manipulate and really trap youth into the sex trade.
Okay, we're going to talk more about this with Celia Williamson in just a moment. For the first time in 50 years, a Kennedy will not be serving in Congress. Here's a clip from a video that will air over the weekend from Rhode Island Congressman Patrick Kennedy, son of the late Ted Kennedy.
Now, having spent 2 decades in politics, my life is taking a new direction.
and I will not be a candidate for re-election this year.
Patrick Kennedy served 8 terms in Congress. And the Winter Olympics beginning in Vancouver today, the first ever indoor opening ceremonies tonight. And in honor of the Olympics, we're asking you about this year's games. If you had a chance to be in the Olympics, what event would you choose to compete in? You can even make up one if it doesn't exist. But give us a call at 8778-MYTAKE or post to our website, thetakeaway.org.
Better than expected retail sales in January, and Asian and European markets are mixed. Futures are down still. The Dow gets underway at 10,144, the S&P at 1,078. The NASDAQ opens at 2177. Coming up, more details of that disturbing sex trade story out of Ohio.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
You know, when I read the results of a report on human trafficking yesterday, I thought I'd read it wrong. It said about 1,000 American-born children are forced into the sex trade every year. And I expected that to be 1,000 every year out of the nation. That's 1,000 in the state of Ohio alone. It's a stunning statistic. Joining us to talk about it again is Celia Williamson, a professor at the University of Toledo. Celia's leading research efforts at the Ohio Trafficking in Persons Study Commission that published that report on Monday. And we also have Teresa Flores with us. She was an actual victim of human trafficking, and she's author of the book The Slave Across the Street, The True Story of How an All-American Teenager Survived the World of Human Trafficking. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Celia, this report that you have issued, like I said, I thought that would be 1,000 out of the country. That's 1,000 out of Ohio. What do these numbers look like when you spread them across the country?
Well, there's been several estimates. The government's estimate has been about 17,500, but their study methodology is very elusive and not very well done, even admitted by them. Other studies have been over 72,000 just coming through the southwest border as international victims. And then there hasn't been a large study done in a meaningful way in terms of domestic children, American-born children, but the estimates are about 100,000.
What is the typical story here? Who is this that is victimizing children, and what are they forcing them to do?
Well, I think they're organized. Well, I know there are organized sex trafficking rings happening around the nation, and they're manipulating and forcing children into the sex trade. And it has become the second largest illegal enterprise in the world, human trafficking, and it's a booming business in the U.S.
Teresa, you were actually a victim of sex trafficking. This began when you were 15 years old. Can you tell us how this began and how you got trapped into continuing this?
It really, you know, the same way it happens now is I was vulnerable and I moved around a lot. So I didn't have a really good support network around me. I didn't have, you know, aunts and uncles or grandparents that I could talk to or that would notice any of the red flags, any of the changes in me. And, you know, was just targeted by a group of men who saw this, and they used a technique that is very common even today, in that they showed, you know, one of them showed me a lot of attention, and, you know, it's called grooming, where they give you a lot of love and tell you how wonderful you are, and then something very simple, they just offered me a ride home from school one day, and ended up taking me not to home, but to his home, and giving me a pop that was laced with some sort of drug and raped me. And then I found out later that they there was other people there, and they had taken pictures of the rape and then essentially blackmailed me into earning them back.
So this was a young man that you thought was going to be a boyfriend, and in fact it got you into the sex trade because he threatened to show these photos of you to your parents and to the school, and your parents did not know this was going on. How is that possible?
It's very, you know, very possible, very easy. When your life is on the line and someone's telling you that they're going to kill you and your family, you go to all lengths to keep that quiet. So it was very easy to keep that from them.
But how did it work? Were you going out and doing this activity with your parents not knowing? How did that actually function?
What happened was I had a private phone in my room, and so they would call my room, and my dad traveled a lot, so he was gone about 3 weeks out of the month on business, And, you know, my mom was the kind of mom that when you went to bed, you said goodnight and you went into your rooms and you shut your door and you saw each other the next day. And so they would call my room and say, you need to appear immediately. And so I would essentially just sneak out and go to a different street behind my house, and a car and driver would be waiting.
Teresa, can you tell me, I mean, you've become an activist on this issue. How do we deal when we find out cases of human trafficking? What happens to these girls?
Well, say that again, when we find the cases?
When we find these cases, how does it work through our system?
You know, that's a good question, because we know that the FBI knows that they're there, law enforcement, but it's really difficult because there's no place to put them once we get them and rescue them. So there's very few social services and shelters and places out there to take them to. So they usually end up in jail, like detention center, or into a foster care home.
Celia, is our system set up? I mean, we don't obviously have good research on this issue, but is our legal system, our law enforcement system, set up to take care of this problem?
Absolutely not. Actually, I went to a meeting in Washington, D.C. about this issue across the U.S., and one of the main problems was that the criminal justice, the social service, and the healthcare system are not educated about this issue. They don't know how to identify victims, and they are our first responders. But on top of that, when our child victims are rescued from trafficking, they're often incarcerated in detention centers across the U.S., despite the fact that under the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, which is a federal law that says any child under the age of 18 that is involved in prostitution is a victim of the crime of human trafficking, cities across the U.S. are still incarcerating our kids.
Well, Teresa Flores is now the director of awareness and training at Grace Haven. That's a shelter for girls that's not quite opened yet. Teresa, do you have advice for parents on how to keep this from happening to their own kids?
There are red flags, and they need to find out what those are and look for them and be observant, and just keep good communication open with their child. If you see something, you know, don't assume that it's just a teenager, you know, going through hormones. You know, ask and find out where they're going, and check on them in the middle of the night. You know, you have to get up in the middle of the night and see if they're in their bed. I mean, it's just simple things like that.
Be nosy with your kids, I guess. Teresa Flores was a victim of trafficking at the age 15. She's the author of The Slave Across the Street, the true story of how an all-American teenager survived the world of human trafficking. And Celia Williamson also joined us, professor in the University of Toledo's School of Social Work. And now at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in on the top stories.
The Winter Olympics are nearly upon us in Vancouver, British Columbia. U.S. Olympic ski jumper Emily Cook told NBC Sports this morning she's looking forward to tonight's opening ceremony.
Just looking up and looking around and seeing everybody, you know, cheering us on and, you know, just feeling all that support is really the most exciting thing ever.
And for the next 2 weeks, we're going to hear voices like that quite a lot. In other news, the people of Haiti are holding a national day of mourning today, exactly a month after the earthquake struck. A ceremony will be held later close to the devastated cathedral in the capital, Port-au-Prince. A Haitian teacher told our partner, the BBC, this morning that people who haven't found the remains of their family members have mixed feelings about today's commemorations.
Today, people are trying to remember those they have lost, but at the same time, you have people, still have family members, mothers, fathers, or sons, who are still under the doorbells, and they haven't pulled these people out yet.
Several large circus tents previously used by Cirque du Soleil are on their way to Haiti to be used as temporary headquarters for the Haitian government.
Former President Bill Clinton is at home in Chappaqua, New York, recovering from a procedure yesterday to unclog an artery close to his heart. Doctors say his prognosis is excellent. And in Georgia, a soldier who refused to be deployed to Afghanistan will not face a court-martial. Alexis Hutchinson is a single mother who argued she had no one to care for her infant son. She's facing demotion and will lose all military and veteran benefits. That's a look at some of the stories you're watching this morning. Coming up...
labels do matter, because without labels and mental illness, you could not get treatment.
We talked about the importance of labels for psychiatrists, and today you've told us about how important they are to you. We're going to get your responses in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now we have some takeouts on stories that we're following this week, and it was 1 month ago today that the earth shook for 40 terrifying seconds in Haiti. 40 seconds that left around 200,000 people dead and leveled most of the capital city. It is a national day of mourning there today, with a ceremony to be held in the ruins of the National Palace in Port-au-Prince. We turn now to Gypsy Metalou. She's the executive director of Saint-Lan, a Haitian neighborhood center in Miami. Gypsy, are there events going on in Miami today to observe this day of mourning?
Yes, good morning, Celeste. There are a number of events and especially prayer services, prayer vigils to honor the memory of all the victims, as well as, you know, to encourage the survivors.
We've heard a lot about how the community in South Florida especially is drawn closer to Haiti in the wake of this tragedy. And I'm wondering if we're starting to see those bonds begin to loosen as a month has gone by.
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. If anything, those bonds that had always been there, and they tended to be strengthened in the wake of every natural disaster we've known in Haiti, you know, the earthquakes and the like. But I think that this earthquake has really, I think, solidified those bonds and in fact garnered additional support from non-Haitians. That's really been very tremendous. The outpouring of support from just about everyone throughout the United States and throughout the world has been unprecedented, and I think that's been unique,
Gypsy,
really, in the history of disasters.
Gypsy Metalou, an executive director of Saint-Lan, a Haitian neighborhood center in Miami.
Our next takeout from Washington, Todd Zwillick, D.C. correspondent, joins us. Todd, a jobs bill from the Democrats seems to be a test of this new bipartisanship they're talking about. How's it going?
Well, it was, John, but the bipartisanship part of it isn't going well at all. It was, well, in a Washington kind of way, sort of exciting yesterday, I guess, when the Finance Committee was working on a bipartisan jobs bill. They had buy-in from some senior Republicans. Max Baucus, the chairman of the Finance Committee, rolled out this draft bill, and Republicans were on board. It had jobs-building measures. It had some reforms to the estate tax. It had some other things, some routine tax extenders that Republicans wanted. And everyone was kind of getting used to the feeling of bipartisanship because they haven't flexed those muscles in so long. And then it took a couple of hours for Harry Reid to yank the bill and say he wasn't going to put it on the floor. Instead, he's going with something much, much more narrow, as sort of a narrow job-creating package, supposed to be a job-creating package that has some tax credits for small business, some incentives for states to spend some money on infrastructure. But it doesn't have any of the stuff that Republicans wanted that got them on board, and Republicans reacted angrily. They said Harry Reid went partisan and yanked the rug out from under them right as they were making progress. So this thing's going to get voted on after the President's Day recess, but right now the bipartisanship seems to have waned a little bit.
And is there a backstory here?
There doesn't seem to be. I don't think it's personal or anything like that. Harry
right.
Reid said that he thought that this bipartisan package was going to lose support among his liberals, the liberal Senate Democrats. But, you know, they don't want the estate tax reformed in a way that's an advantage to the super rich. That was their problem. So he saw this thing possibly teetering, and I don't think that he feels they can afford a defeat right now with the way the jobs market is.
All right, Todd Zwillick, our Washington correspondent, talking about the jobs bill and bipartisanship not in Washington.
And our last takeout is about the power of labels.
Labels do matter, because without labels and mental illness, you could not get treatment.
We talked yesterday about the American Psychiatric Association's DSM, the manual that decides how we label all types of mental disorders, and we've been getting your stories on the effects that labels have, like this one from Sabrina in Harlem.
If I didn't have the correct diagnoses, I wouldn't have the correct drugs and be able to get the funding for the hospitalizations, et cetera, that I really needed to get through my life to the point where I'm actually functional after a number of years of just a complete mess.
But like everything, it's a two-way street. Brad's a counselor in Oklahoma. He tells us on our site, thetakeaway.org, I've found in the people I work with that a label can be distressing or leave someone with an equal but opposite sense of relief. Much of what a label means is based in what importance the person being labeled places upon the diagnosis that's declared. I found one of the single most damaging labels has been over the over-diagnosing of youth with bipolar disorder.
Yeah, I don't know where I come down on this issue here, but I was glad to hear this listener in Michigan calling 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Labels, yes, while they do help when you finally find out that you have a mental illness, and so there is help out there, such as my bipolar, but they also hurt your children and people who love you when they hear people banter it around and call other people that name or any other kind of names. They hurt, and it also leaves the next generation wondering, am I next?
Social worker named Allie wrote in to tell us this. My concern is that in some cases, when a family is desperate to pin a label on their child and blame the child for behaviors that actually stem from the family's dysfunction, it is easier in those cases for the family to point to the child and say, you are experiencing these issues because there is something wrong with you, insert diagnosis here, rather than the parents taking responsibility for their role in the child's behavior. That's a big debate among psychiatrists. That's true.
Yeah, we have some really compelling conversations going back and forth, and if you want to continue that conversation, you can go to our website. You can also re-listen to the segment about this and share it with your family and friends and ask them to weigh in. That's thetakeaway.org. You can reach us anytime with whatever has you thinking at 877-8 My Take. Coming up, we're going to talk about the Winter Olympics, and we're going to speak with the first black ice skating figure skating pair, how they found each other. Here's a hint, not very far off from something like eHarmony. But we're asking you, what event would you want to compete in if you were going to be in the Winter Olympics? And yes, you can make up your own. Somebody calling herself Brooklyn Chick posts to our site, identifying celebrity voiceovers on commercials. Hey, couch potatoes need the Olympics too.
Is that winter? I guess that would be winter.
It could be winter. Yeah, because you're indoors. Yeah, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. We're going to kick off the games with what to watch for in the games.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, assessing the state of the Iranian opposition with someone from the BBC Persian Service and Gary Sick, analyst from Columbia University. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour, 1 month after the earthquake. It's a day of mourning in Haiti to mark the one-month anniversary of the earthquake, which left around 200,000 people dead and a million homeless.
In Afghanistan, tribal elders are asking NATO forces to wage their imminent offensive on the Taliban stronghold of Marja quickly and carefully to protect civilians in and around the town. Captain Joshua Rinfrey is a Marines company commander on the front line near Marja.
I'm expecting some fairly significant resistance, especially within the first few days that we go in.
As many as 1,000 Taliban fighters are believed to be dug in. And let the games begin. The Winter Olympics in Vancouver get underway today with the first ever indoor opening ceremonies tonight. U.S. Olympic freestyle ski jumper Jarrett Speedy Peterson tells NBC News.
It's one of my favorite part of the Olympics is getting to walk into opening ceremonies.
Good thing it's indoors since the forecast calls for rain tonight and throughout the weekend. Taking a look at the markets, the Dow is down about 87, the S&P down about 8, and the Nasdaq down about 20. So those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
So yesterday, a lot of the media was focused on Iran, where there were demonstrations on both sides, pro and anti-government, for the 31st anniversary of the beginning of the Islamic Revolution that transformed Iran, certainly transformed the Middle East, and has been a theme in U.S.-Iranian relations, of course, ever since. Joining us now to sort of take a look at what happened yesterday and try to figure out what it means for going forward is Siavash Ardalan, host of the BBC Persian TV's interactive show Your Turn. He's been covering Wednesday's protests for our partner, the BBC, and the BBC Persian TV is based in London, where he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also, Gary Sick, an Iran expert at Columbia University with long experience analyzing and studying Iran, also joins us from New York City. Gary, good morning.
Good morning.
First of all, Gary Sick, what did you make of what happened yesterday? Is it possible to score the opposition and the government? It seemed as though the government was able to project that it has the upper hand here.
I think there's no doubt about it. I mean, the government won this battle, and part of, I think the only reason why they won the battle is that they have actually mastered some of the techniques. They've learned how to really turn off the internet quite effectively. They had their troops out in very strategic locations. They jumped on every small demonstration the moment it began to appear. They beat up leaders of the opposition when they tried to make an appearance. And at the same time, they bust in massive numbers of people for a show of force. And it was a one-sided operation. And I think the opposition is going to have to rethink itself.
Siavash Ardalan from the BBC Persian TV service. Yesterday on this program, Stephen Kinzer, who's written a lot about Iran, suggested that there's a constraint and dynamic going on in the opposition that, based on the experience of the Islamic Revolution, Iranians fear another big revolution and fear perhaps the pendulum swinging all the way in the other direction here. And as a result, they're inclined to go much more cautiously. Do you buy that theory?
Well, this is really the essence of the soul-searching that's going on right now among the Green Movement. Many of them are supporting this idea, including its leader, Mir Hossein Mousavi, himself being a revolutionary. He now supports the idea of reform and is emphasizing that we're not trying to overthrow the government. What we're simply pursuing are reforms within the Constitution. If there's any changes in the Constitution that are to be made, it should be done through peaceful means. Yet, the Green Movement, you know, covers a vast array of predispositions and of political thinking, many of them also inclined towards more violent upheaval. And this is a conversation that's going on amongst them as we speak.
Gary Sick, is reform possible given the constraints within the Iranian government and the kinds of crackdowns that you've already talked about?
Well, I think what we're seeing is that the opposition started out being very mild, actually calling for rather small reforms and small changes. They have become more and more demanding as time goes on and as the repression has grown. And I think what's going to happen now is either that the regime permits a reformist group to actually operate as an opposition, or you're going to see it go underground even more and become more radical and be taken over by people who really do want to overthrow the government and will do so violently. I think the tactics of the government are understandable in the sense that they've discovered how to actually manage repression effectively. But I think in the short term that may help them, but in the long term it actually undercuts their legitimacy, and that is essentially... That's their strongest card, mm-hmm. and they're losing that all the time.
And, a nuclear physicist will tell you that crowing about having 20% enriched uranium is kind of like crowing about having a bunch of X-ray machines. It's not even close to what it would take to make weaponized uranium. Nevertheless, President Ahmadinejad yesterday declared Iran a nuclear power because of this 20% enriched uranium. Does he have an argument, and does it resonate with the people?
I believe this is the third time he has announced that Iran is a nuclear nation, so I don't think there's anything new in that. This is something that he trots out every time there's a major national holiday. Basically, they can enrich uranium to 20%. They can go beyond that if they want to. The trick is not to sit back and say, oh my goodness, they must be building a bomb because they've got about half a gram of enriched uranium. But to say, all right, how do we stop them from going on from here? And I think that's the point where the West and the United States really don't, they haven't got an answer to that.
Siavash Ardalan, finally, you talked about an internal conversation that's taking place within the opposition. I'm wondering if the techniques that Gary Sick has talked about of controlling the information flow, particularly in the internet, are lessons that may be drawn by other nations, say China, even the U.S., in trying to control information. This was an unprecedented moment yesterday.
Absolutely. I think as time goes on, as the state realizes how are the best ways to deal with the opposition, they're learning their lessons. And yesterday showed that they've done their homework as well, bringing down the internet connections down to a crawl, and not just with the internet connection and the what's going on in cyberspace, but the country has virtually changed into a police state over the past few weeks. They've just embarked on this massive campaign of intimidation and arresting journalists, bloggers, minorities, and people we don't even sometimes hear about because their families don't want news of it to be leaked. So the government is learning how to repress the opposition better, but the opposition has a problem of trying to find, you know, different ways, creative ways of dealing with this. And so far, the best idea they've come up with so far has been to try to hijack some of these state-sanctioned anniversaries.
Right.
Come out to the streets, but I think they've exhausted this method.
Siavash Ardalan, host of the BBC Persian TV's program Your Turn. Gary Sick, is President Ahmadinejad out of the woods here in the moments before we go?
Absolutely not.
He's being
opposed by people in his own party and is anything but a popular figure at this point.
More to come out of Iran. Gary Sick, Iran expert at Columbia University, talking about the protest during yesterday's 31st Islamic Revolution anniversary on the streets of Tehran. Coming up, merge the best parts of online dating with ice skating, and what do you get? The Winter Olympics' first black skating couple. How do they become a couple? You'll find out later on this hour. And we're asking you, what event would you want to compete in if you were in the Olympics? Make up one of your own. Mark posts to our site, Australian rules, curling, thin ice over deep water.
Ooh.
Nice. Darren simply writes, ice crunking. Yeah, but can you do that on the ice? Yeah. Tell us at 877-8MYTAKE or post it to your website, The Takeaway. Your website, that's right.
It is their website.
Takeaway.org.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. The fashion world lost an icon yesterday. Authorities found British fashion designer Alexander McQueen dead in his apartment in London. They suspect suicide. When McQueen started his career in London's Savile Row, the hub of old-school English tailoring, he made a name for himself by being a little what we might call cheeky. He described this in a 1997 interview on The Frank Skinner Show in Britain.
I'm in Savile Row with a load of old tailors, and you start padding the canvas, which makes the jacket. It just happens to be Prince Charles's jacket I was working on at the time. And so I draw this big willy on it.
Here to talk about the legacy of is New York Times fashion critic Kathy Horn, who wrote a lengthy profile on McQueen last year. Kathy, give us an idea of who Alexander McQueen was. Maybe people know him for designing Lady Gaga's lobster shoes that she wore in her Bad Romance video, but who was this man?
Well, he was a complicated guy who grew up in the East End of London. His father was a taxi driver. He was very close to his mother, Joyce, who just passed away about a week ago. He went to Central St. Martin's, which is one of the top schools in London, but as you heard on that clip, he was also trained on Savile Row. You know, he was a very smart guy who could be very funny, very brash with people, super hard-working guy, I think a very hard partier, too, if he wanted to. And then, of course, we in the fashion world, we knew him for these incredible shows that he did over the last 15 years. I think that he was... he was one of those really exceptional people in the business for being intelligent and also being incredibly capable with his hands. So he got the conceptual part of fashion, that fashion was more than just wearable, you know, clothes. But at the same time, he could make anything. He did his own patterns.
His runway shows were known for being more performance art than just a strict fashion show, and yet he was himself a kind of a modest individual coming from working class backgrounds, and he wasn't necessarily one of the outsized fame seekers that we know of in the fashion world.
Well, I think he's the real deal. I think he was a super talent, and I think when Lee, everybody knew him as Lee because that was his first name. When, you know, Lee was very interested in the work. He loved going into the studio. He loved working with all those people, getting the things done, making things the way he wanted to. I think he thought a lot about being the 21st century designer. And as you said, he was a really kind, decent, super sensitive, nice guy. He told you what he thought about stuff. He didn't hold back on anything like that. But another, I think that was one of the. I wouldn't know if whether it's a conflict or a dichotomy in Lee that he did come from this working class background. He did spend almost all of his life until the last year or two living in the East End of London. His business was still based there, although he did show in Paris for a while. He worked for the House of Givenchy, a couture house. So he certainly knew a lot of the really good contemporary British artists. So he could travel in that world. He could work at the very heights of fashion.
And his death has cast a somber mood over the New York Fashion Week, which began this Wednesday. Reports of a possible suicide of the British designer Alexander McQueen. That's Kathy Horn. She's the fashion critic for our partner, the New York Times.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. And coming up, you're going to meet a couple people who will be appearing in the Olympics, a couple who met on the internet through a sort of skaters online dating service. And they're also about to set some history as well. We'll talk to them in just a few moments. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. January was better than expected for the nation's retailers. The Commerce Department says retail sales rose 0.5% last month. That's the best showing since November and higher than economists expected. The Mid-Atlantic has been snowed in for days, and now it's the South's turn to get it. A rare winter storm along the Gulf Coast has already left Texas with more than a foot of snow, and parts of Louisiana got at least 5 inches before dawn.
They could use it up in Vancouver, where the Winter Olympics is about to kick off tonight. The South is getting the Winter Olympics snow. There isn't as much as usual, but it's not expected to stop the opening ceremonies, which are later today. In the U.S., former President Bill Clinton back home in Chappaqua, New York, after a procedure yesterday to unclog an artery to his heart. Doctors say his prognosis is excellent. And despite the positive economic news this morning, stocks are falling along with oil. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, all 30 stocks are down. This morning it's below 140 points lower at the open. Finally, the man credited with inventing the Frisbee, one of the world's most popular toys, has died at the age of 90. Walter Frederick Morrison developed his plastic flying discs during the 1950s. Over the next half century, hundreds of millions of Frisbees were sold worldwide. There's even a game, Frisbee Golf. Do you play that with Grant?
No.
Frisbee Golf? My brother is a big Frisbee Golf player. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Ask any pairs figure skater, and they'll tell you that sometimes finding their match on the ice is more complicated and more difficult than finding a match off the ice. That's why there's actually an online pairs figure skating introduction site. It's like a match.com, but it's exclusively for skaters who are looking to find a skating partner. And that's how our next guests met. Vanessa James and Yannick Bonheur were set up on icepartnersearch.com. They're about to compete in their first Olympic match as a team. They are the French national champions. They're skating for France this weekend, and they will be the first black pairs skating team ever to compete in the Olympic Games. Vanessa, let's start with you. Can you explain to our listeners what makes finding a match so difficult that you had to turn to a kind of blind dating sort of website in order to find your partner, Yannick?
There are so few boys, actually, in figure skating, and also there are few boys that are strong enough or tall enough or experienced enough. So it is difficult. We have more girls in figure skating than boys, so it's always difficult to find a boy and then someone that you're compatible with. So
kind of the same problem we all had in fourth grade square dancing class, right?
Exactly.
So Yannick, Vanessa flew out to France, and she did an audition with you. How did that audition go?
Really good. First impression was perfect. It was really connected together. I felt something with Vanessa. It was really great.
How did you know she was the one? You got a few responses from the website.
Yes, I was a few responses from a Canadian or U.S. girl. But at the beginning, doesn't work, and we saw Vanessa. I saw a few videos from her, and when we get on the ice and try a few elements, I knew it was her.
Vanessa, did you have the same instant connection?
Yes, we both knew that we wanted to skate together within the first day of skating together. And after the first 3 days, it was perfect, and we had already made our decision. We always laughed. All the elements worked really well, and we both looked very nice. We have really good lines on the ice.
But you had an accident during your early training, isn't that right?
It was the first day I came back to France to actually... I cut his hand the first day just before we were about to finish practice. We were actually in the middle of a spiral sequence, and I had to let go of my foot, and his hand just happened to be there. It was in my way.
That's not the most auspicious way to start a partnership together, but I guess it turned out pretty well. You guys experienced success pretty early on.
We've only been skating for 2 years, and at the Olympics we'll be competing against couples that have been skating together from 5 years to 15 years. So we have accomplished a lot. We've done 2 European championships and world championships where we got our place for the Olympics this year.
Now, because of the changing rules in terms of nationality and country of origin, we see all kinds of pairs of skaters who are born in different countries, hold multiple citizenships. And Vanessa, you're a really good example for that. Can you kind of give us an idea of your international status?
Yes, I have identity crisis. I was actually born in Canada. I have British citizenship through my parents, who are both British. And we've been living in the U.S. for about 10 years now. And I moved recently 2 years ago to France, and I now have a French citizenship.
So do you feel any sense of, I guess, dislocation in terms of what country you're actually skating for and representing in the Olympics?
Yes. I wasn't sure what country I wanted to skate for because I had the opportunity to skate for many. I'm proud to represent France. I was very welcome to skate there, and I have Yannick's family, who was very loving, and I spent Christmas with them. And all of France has been very supportive, and I found my perfect partner. So
Yannick, you were not looking to find a black partner. You were just looking for somebody with the athleticism and the kind of relationship that you needed. But you ended up with another black skater, and you're now going to be the first black figure skaters to perform as a team in the entire history of the Olympics.
Yes, that's true. The first time I just watch and search for a partner, and I found Vanessa. She's a black girl, but the first impression, we didn't think about that. And it's true now, everybody talk about first black pair in Olympic, and we are actually really proud about that, and we want like push the pair skating for black, because there is no many, and we think we can arrive and be good.
Yeah.
Vanessa, can you tell me about what that moment was like? Maybe it was the moment when somebody first pointed it out to you or first asked you about it. How do you feel as the first black figure skaters in the Olympics? Was that a moment where you kind of went, whoa, wait, am I?
Yeah, we didn't really know if we were the first, because we know we have seen other black skaters in the sport, like there's Robin. He's a German black skater, pair skater also, skating with a Ukrainian girl. There was also Sergio Bonnelly from France. But yes, when people told us we were the first, we were surprised but very proud. And like Yannick said, we want to encourage other people to skate and to be the best in skating, because it is rare to see black skaters on the ice.
Do you feel like it puts pressure on you? I mean, there's going to be the eyes of thousands, perhaps millions of black kids from all over the world watching you guys as an example and role models.
Yeah, I don't feel like it's a lot of pressure. Not at all. We have pressure on ourselves for just skating for our country, for our families, for just for ourselves. And I think no matter what we do and how we skate, I think that we can represent all the other black children, and we can represent them just being at the Olympics and have reached this level already.
If I know nothing about this sport technically, what do you guys offer as a pair that I'm not going to see from another pair of skaters?
I think it is our athleticism and our color on the ice. I mean, it does stand out. It's beautiful against the white ice. And we're very athletic. We have very muscular bodies, and some of our throws are the best in the world. They're very high, and Yannick is very muscular, very strong, and
he's
our
tall.
Lifts are very good. So I think it's more that than anything else.
Would you agree with that, Yannick?
Yes, I totally agree with that.
Well, you guys make a very handsome pair. Vanessa James and Yannick Bonner, they're pairs of figure skaters that will be skating for France in the upcoming Olympics. Thanks, and good luck to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I will definitely give them the gold medal in confidence going to the Olympics. For more of the people behind the Olympics, you can listen back to our interviews from this week and all next week when we're covering the Olympics. You can go to our website, thetakeaway.org. And we're asking you, what event would you want to compete in if you were in the Olympics? And go ahead, make up one of your own.
This is Susan Miller from Manhattan. I would like to compete in the smorgasbording Olympics.
Interesting. Bex posts to our site, I would have poker added to the Winter Games, but each nation's player would have to gamble with its country's GDP and do it naked outside in the snow, perhaps.
What?
That would give
Wait,
it a winter
no,
quality.
Didn't write that.
No, they didn't write that. I just added that, but that's good. Tell us your take. 877-8-MINDTAKER posted to your website. Yes, it's your website, thetakeaway.org. There's also this special project that needs your photos. We're doing a dog show next week in honor of me being gone. Send us a photo of your pet, your four-legged dog. Three-legged dog's okay. Best in show will be judged by us and the listeners. Go to thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headlee, giving a plug for my beagle.
Have a great weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. I'll be on vacation next week. Enjoy Todd Zwillick filling in for me. Does he have a dog? This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.